This is the fourth in a series of eight lessons on the Sermon on the Mount. And the title of this lesson is, As a Person Thinketh. Now, I started to say, As a Man Thinketh. And it occurred to me that to get the full attention of this audience, that I should transform what is written there. If you and I should hear every hour on the hour for the rest of our lives a statement to the effect that our outer world is but a reflection of our inner state of mind, it probably would not be often enough. We can spend the rest of our days considering this great truth and still not fully understand the implications that are there. But the lesson tonight, as a matter of fact, the entire message of the Sermon on the Mount deals with this basic law of the universe, that as we think and feel inside ourselves, so is the world around us shaped or formed. And as we are changed, so does our world change. And there is no other process. There is no other way. But listen to these truths. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. As I read that statement to you, I hope you noticed how poetically beautiful it sounded. But if listened to in English as we understand English, it had practically no meaning, no significant meaning, no useful meaning to us. And this has been one of the problems with we who have tried to use the life-transforming words of the message of Jesus Christ in our lives. Let's remember that this statement was written 2,000 years ago. These ideas were conveyed in a language, an idiom, that had great meaning to the people of that time. As a matter of fact, they had a tremendous impact on the consciousness of the listener. And this is because Jesus used the language of words, but he also used the language of symbols. Remember that in the language that he used, the only language that he knew, there were less than 700 words in use. Today, you and I have 35,000 words, more or less, with which we can use. Perhaps we don't have them all in our vocabulary, but you can readily read and understand most of those words. Well, Jesus used not only the language of words, but also an even more powerful language of metaphor, a language that could hardly be misunderstood by the people to whom he was carrying his message. And you have often heard it said that the Bible must be taken literally, but I say to you that it cannot be taken just literally. Remember the scriptures that it said that without a parable spake he not unto them, so he did not speak literally. For example, let's take the first sentence that I read to you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, and that's hardly a statement that is very significant to you or to me, as lovely as it is. We've heard it many times, but let's see if we can hear it with new ears and come up with a new understanding of what it means. The time that this parable was used salt was a thing of exceeding value. It was necessary for life. There were parts of the world that salt was not available. It had to be transported, and it was a very heavy cargo. It was of exceptional value because of its great need for people, and also because it was so hard to come by. It was an element of food, but it was also used as a preservative, because remember, they didn't have refrigeration or other means of preserving things as we now have. And salt was of such value that it was used in trade. It was a medium of exchange, probably more valuable than gold because of its multiple purposes. So when Jesus said, "You're the salt of the earth," he was talking about something special, something of great value and significance. In those days, you could not run down to the corner grocery store and get a package of iodized salt for 25 cents and come home and shake it out. It just wasn't available. Well, the whole language of the Bible is just like this. Great impact when we begin to understand the inner meaning of what was being said. And this wonderful message, Jesus is talking to those people who have awakened to the understanding of their self-imposed limitation and who had acquired some understanding of the spiritual nature of life and of the fact that they were in a process of being transformed. He was talking to the people who were beginning to comprehend the allness of God, the fact that they were spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe and that it was possible for them to be changed as a result of understanding and practicing spiritual principles. It was to these people that he was speaking when he said, "You're the salt of the earth." He wasn't just making a flat statement to everyone, but to those who are in the process of being awakened. And such people, as he describes, as being the salt of the earth and the light of the world, are people who can claim to be exactly what he was talking about. It's possible, in fact, only too easy to accept these statements as being rather impractical, and perhaps to see the beauty in them and yet not be able to understand them in a manner that will permit us to put them into practice in our own experience, in our own lives. Spiritual principles must be practiced. They must be demonstrated. The spiritual life is not a theory. It must be practiced. It must be demonstrated. A true religion is not something that you can join. It's something that you must do. A spiritual life is not something that one can just understand. We cannot really understand the spiritual life until we're caught up in the practicing of it. And by practicing, I mean that we need to know that the value of implementing these principles in our daily affairs. For example, you know the value of prayer and of meditation, don't you? The absolute importance of taking time each day to establish your conscious contact with God. There's nothing in our lives more important than this. And yet, how much time have you spent today practicing prayer or meditation, establishing your conscious contact with God? There's nothing in our life that's more important than this. And yet we spend far more time feeding our bodies than we do feeding our minds, our souls. We spend more time at the hamburger stand than we do in meditation. And maybe you don't. But if you don't, then you are the exception. You're the one then that would be called the salt of the earth, or the person who is a light that is not hid under a bushel. One of the things that we discover, and I think I mentioned it in last week's lesson, is that when we become involved with the spiritual life and then for a period of time, stop practicing these principles, it is worse for us than before we knew that such principles existed. For example, there were times in the past before you knew the difference that you could do things and not experience the consequences of those actions. There were times when you could fudge or cheat or enjoy being depressed without having to experience the consequences of that unacceptable emotional behavior. But try it now and see what happens to you. Your whole world begins to rock and fall apart. You just can't get away with it anymore, can you? Well, if we understand and accept the teachings of Jesus, we come to know that the spiritual life is not a theory, that we have to put it into practice in every corner of our lives. And so often we hesitate to do so because we think that if we do, that we might lose some of the benefits that we have experienced in just being an ordinary person. Well, it's so important to know that if you make the effort to practice these principles in your daily life, if you seek systematically to destroy in yourself everything which you know should not be there, things such as selfishness and pride and vanity and anger and resentment, jealousy, blaming other persons, feeling guilty, if you will deprive yourself of the opportunity of experiencing those negatives, that you will become one of those persons who will be worthy of being known as the salt of the earth. If you truly live this life, then it does not in the least matter what your present circumstances may be or what difficulties that you may be struggling with at any moment. You have been given the absolute promise that you will triumph over any problems that might exist and that you will make your demonstration, that you will succeed. And not only will you make your own demonstration in the quickest possible time, but you will, and in a very positive and literal sense, become a blessing and illuminating influence on all of the people who exist in the world around you. And in time, you'll become a blessing to the whole human race, to people that you will never meet. You'll be a blessing to men and women in remote places and times who have never heard of you and who will never hear of you. You will truly be, what he said, a light of the world. As startling and as wonderful as that may sound, as incredible as that may sound to you, your consciousness will reach out and touch men and women, all parts of this planet. The state of your being is always expressed in your outer conditions and in the intangible influence which you radiate at large. There's a cosmic law that nothing can permanently deny its own nature. Emerson said it, "What you are shouts so loudly that I cannot hear what you say." What you are, what you are feeling, what you're being becomes, and it moves with power, and it touches and heals. Changes. In the Bible, the word city always stands for consciousness, but it usually means crystallized states of consciousness. And that's why that in the Old Testament that so many cities had to be destroyed. Our old consciousness had to be destroyed. Our attitudes, our outlook, our belief system had to be destroyed. And that's why that in the metaphor of that was used in the Old Testament, the city and all of its inhabitants had to be destroyed. The word hill or mountain always means prayer or spiritual activity. Going up into a mountain to pray, implying the elevation of consciousness. I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills, from whence cometh my help. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. And the life that is built upon this process of introspection, examination, and prayer is a life that blesses everyone around it in a very special way. One of the things that we so often want to do when we begin to grow along spiritual lines is to change the people in the world around us, and I know that you've wanted to do that. Gosh, if you could just get them fixed, how wonderful it would be. And the tendency is to grab them by the hand, and you would be surprised how often I get a call from someone who says, I can't fix them, but would you call them? Well, I can take you right now to my telephone file, and there are several of those calls that I've been asked to make. Would you like to know the very best way that you can change people? You want to know what it is? You're doing it. It's to become the truth. It is to become these principles. It is to practice them so diligently in your own life, so enthusiastically, bringing about the dramatic changes that you want in your own beingness and in your own world, so that you become an example, a powerful example that cannot be denied, that cannot be ignored. You're not just talking about it, but you're doing it. You're living it. And because you live it, other people will see it, and for a time they may try to deny it, particularly if they've known you for a long time. But then you become a city upon a hill that cannot be hidden. Isn't that an amazing metaphor when you stop and think about it? A city, your consciousness becomes so elevated that it cannot be hidden. No one can ignore it. This is a powerful church. I mean the consciousness. This church. The group of us gathered here represent an incredible body of confidence and faith and belief in God. But gather us all together. It's amazing. The power that we have here. But do you know how most of us get here? Do you know how? You know how? They followed you. And you got here because you saw someone else, didn't you? And you said to yourself, whatever it is that they have, I want some of it too. I can see the powerful influence in their life. You become a city that is not hidden, that cannot be hidden. Your light shines to the glorifying of your Father, which is in heaven. Jesus Christ knew exactly what he was talking about. But he was saying, it's not just enough to read these principles or to give lip service to them. It's when you become them. When you become them, something remarkable begins to happen. Let me continue with his message. Do not think that I came to destroy the law of the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And what he meant here was that he is the living example, just what I told you about a moment ago. He has said, do you want to see how the system works? Look at me. I'm an example of it. I am the result of practicing these principles in all of my real life situations. And the power that I have comes as a result of that. The understanding, the higher consciousness that I have is the fulfillment of the law that I now submit to you. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, whoever practices these principles and carries the message of them to others and sets the example and helps and causes them to understand and to live by these tenets, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. This higher consciousness. The spiritual life, or true religion, is an entirely positive influence. It comes into our lives to enrich and enlarge them, to make our lives fuller and wider and better, never to restrict us. You cannot lose anything that is worth having through acquiring and practicing and understanding of spiritual principles. Sacrifice there is to be, but it is only sacrifice of the things that one is much happier without, never of anything that is really worth having. Many people have an idea that getting a better knowledge of God will mean giving up things that they will regret losing. I know that that was true for a very brief moment many years ago when I came into this experience. I thought, gosh, if I start thinking and speaking and acting like this, I'll lose all my friends. See, I knew my friends. And then I said, wait a minute. I really need to lose some of those friends. I need to lose the values that I have had in my own belief system. And, you know, I was right. I did lose those friends. But do you know that I never had to pick up the telephone and call one of them and say, I don't think we should see each other? Never. We just stopped seeing each other. It was the most natural experience that I've ever had in my life. When my world changed inside, my world changed around me. And suddenly people were not there. It wasn't that we didn't like or respect each other anymore, but there was just that natural veering away. It was as though we took separate paths up the mountain. You understand what I'm talking about. You can't lose. You can only gain. We will sacrifice selfishness and fear and belief and limitation of any kind. Remember in the book, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, didn't Chang, Jonathan's teacher, tell him that the trick is to stop seeing yourself as a limited being inside a body with a 42-inch wingspan and a performance that could be plotted on a chart? That's what we have to give up. Our sense of personal limitation, that's all. We have to give up the idea that we are limited beings and come to really believe that we are spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe, and in time we find ourselves surrounded by other persons who are moving in the same direction that we are. We're going to have to learn what a human being really is. We are truly spiritual beings, created in the image and likeness of God, and therefore unlimited. To put on unlimited concepts of ourselves, we're going to have to stop seeing that there is power in evil. And by evil, I will use a definition that's in Webster's dictionary. Anything that causes harm, pain, suffering, misery, disaster, and so forth. Evil comes from a root word which means under, thrown backward or under, or lying on the back. The word supine comes from the same word. Now think for a moment of how many things and people that we have given the power to put us under or to put us down. How many things in your life still have the ability to depress you? How many people still have the power to diminish you or to reduce you? The correct answer is none. There's no one or no thing that can put you down or put you under except you yourself. It's only your belief system. And so if there's anything in your life that has the power to diminish you, it is only because you have given power to something that has no power. Was it not Shakespeare who said that there's nothing that is good or bad except thinking makes it so? Wow. The greatest evil in the world is low self-esteem. Any person with low self-esteem, and who among us is fully free of low self-esteem? lives a life that can rise no higher than their own personal level of self-esteem. Jesus said, you will love your neighbor as you love yourself. As you respect yourself, so will you respect and value other persons in the world. When you begin to get the idea that you are this incredible being, that you're the salt of the earth, you're remarkable, you're wonderful, you are the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill and cannot be hidden, when you not only conceptualize this idea, but begin to feel it, and something happens that permits us to be a great influence in the changing of the consciousness of the human race. All poverty, crime, murder, rape, misery, man's inhumanity to man has its roots in low self-esteem. And we will not change this world. We will not change conditions on any other continent or anywhere on this planet until we change, until we raise the level of the self-esteem of mankind. And it begins with you, for you, and me, for me. It is not something that can be done externally, but it is done within us, each one, as a result of our own effort. Has there been or is there still someone in your life that was more powerful than God? So much more powerful that you didn't even bother to pray because you knew God couldn't do anything about him or her. Well, it's when we can begin to see that we shall have no other gods, no other powers, nor circumstances. It's to stop believing in circumstances, and that circumstances have the ability to control or to diminish or to keep us as we are. Every condition and every circumstance that's in your life or my life is but an opportunity for us to demonstrate our spiritual nature. It's an opportunity for us to practice these new concepts and to take this consciousness that is unfolding in us and rearrange the world that exists around us. It is utterly impossible to make any real spiritual progress unless you are honestly trying your very best to live the life. It is utterly impossible to divorce true spiritual knowledge from right conduct unless we're working on our conduct. This is why Plato said the unexamined life is not worth living. Until we can see ourselves and catch ourselves in these little tricks that we play, until we can observe ourselves diligently, moment by moment, and keep ourselves from falling back into our old self-defeating impressions and reactions and behavior. That's why he said that a jot, which is the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet, or a tittle, which is the little horn that's on certain Hebrew letters that distinguish one from the other. He said that these things would pass away before the law would pass away, and that it was necessary for us to practice these principles right down to the last smallest part, that you can't ignore it, you can't pretend it, that you have to play the game of life, and in time the game begins to be fun. When you and I stop taking ourselves so seriously and become aware that this is a game that is very important but also very joyous, we can observe ourselves. And he used the scribes and the Pharisees of his time. They were the people that caused him the most difficulty. But in spite of their defects, they were, for the most part, worthy men leading strictly moral lives according to what they understood at the moment. But he knew that they only understood the letter of the law, and they did not have the spirit of it. They did not have the spiritual key. They were practicing, or they were conforming merely to the traditions of their times and to the belief system that had been handed down to them from the past. And he said that until our practical conduct was in every respect superior to theirs, that we would not make very much spiritual headway. as you grow in your ability to make your day-to-day and hour-to-hour demonstrations, you'll find that there are many rules and regulations that will no longer be necessary for you to practice. And this is not because you and I will ever rise above principles at all. Never, never. We can never rise above them. The point that I'm making here is that in time, you get to where that you don't have to dot all the I's or the T's. Let me give an example. An artist is often thought of as becoming free of the palette, meaning that an artist who might teach students and say, these things you must do if you wish to get your coloring and other things right. That artist, through diligent practice and understanding, will not have to do what the student does. It's not because the artist is above the law, but it's only because he is practicing the law from a higher place, place of greater understanding. There was a time in my life when I did a lot of boating, water skiing, and I taught many people to ski, many of whom could not even swim. And often I would teach people to water ski while they were still on the bank. It's the best place to teach them, as a matter of fact. Wait till they get in the water and they flounder around. But in teaching a new skier, I would say to them, when you're coming up out of the water, keep your arms straight. The boat will pull you up. The tendency will be for you to try to assist the boat. And if you pull back and bend your arms, you will fall. And 100 times out of 100, if a new skier bends their arms, they will fall. It happens every time. But once you become an accomplished skier, you can bend your arms. You can ski with one arm. You can bend it. You can ski backwards. You can do all kinds of things that the new skier is incapable of doing. And this also happens in the spiritual life. You get above the lower level of the practicing of the law. But that comes in time and with practice and with diligence. There are levels and layers of understanding and of expertise, and it begins to be exciting when we understand how the spiritual system works. The way that you can judge yourself as you go along is to observe yourself, to see if your life is more exciting than it was, and if you're less selfish than you were before, if you're more interested in other persons than you are in yourself. Recently, have you found yourself in a conversation in which you were trying to get the attention of the other person, to have all eyes focus on you, to get your point across, and then you caught yourself the middle of it, said, no, it's just my ego. Have you noticed now how much easier it is for you to very lovingly be aware of other people and of their needs and hardly draw any attention to yourself at all? And when the attention is there, you will ask a question that puts it back on the other person because you sincerely want to know where they are and you want to support and to help them. You can feel the deep tenderness that is in you toward people that you never saw before. You can feel a transformation that takes place in you. Well, in order to grow along spiritual lines, you have to begin to demonstrate where you are using the understanding that you have, attempting to bring about certain very important changes while you go about conducting your affairs and assuming your responsibilities in an ordinary manner. And here is this paradox of getting up in the morning and going out to do the things that need to be done by you in the way that you have been doing them, and yet going about your business with a new attitude and observing that attitude and watching it fall for a moment and catching yourself and changing it and once again becoming optimistic, practicing the presence of God and resisting the temptation to be diminished or depressed or angry or resentful, and getting the smile back on your face, back into your heart, and practicing believing in miracles. I opened a letter yesterday and had a little card in there that said, believe in miracles. And I looked at the card and said, well, I believe in miracles. Then I became aware that I wasn't believing in miracles at that moment. I just wasn't even thinking about miracles at that moment. Now, if you had called me a few minutes before and I'd been talking to you, I would have said, expect a miracle, and would have understood what I was talking about and would have believed it, and in all probability would have been expecting a miracle for you, because it's easy for me to do that when I'm talking to you. I can expect miracles for you oftentimes more easily than I can expect them for myself. But when that little card fell out, expect a miracle, I said, gosh, I'm going to sit here practicing, expecting a miracle. And I'll tell you, in about 3 minutes, I was really with it. I was practicing a principle. I took that card and changed my mind about some very specific things. And that's what the spiritual life is about. Taking your mind and changing it, and your life and rearranging it, and your activities and going about them to in a normal way, except it is no longer normal. It is something more than that. Amazing what begins to happen. Now, oftentimes, we don't want to begin with level flight. Remember that Jonathan taught his students to begin with level flight. He had some hot shot young seagulls that wanted to start off doing loop-the-loops because they'd seen Jonathan flying higher and farther and faster than any gull had ever flown. And they said, I think I'm going to do that. And they, one of them flew into a wall and disintegrated, and another crashed into the sea like Jonathan himself had. And he said, no. Let's begin with level flight. Let's start right where you are, doing the ordinary things, transforming the circumstance that's in front of you. And we'll get to the loops later. In the week, or maybe the year. Let's begin with level flight. Let's take a principle and practice it. Let's take a problem and solve it, a relationship and heal it, a defect of character and improve it, a need and fill it. Bring this to the front of your mind and burn it into your consciousness. You have to demonstrate where you are in your life. Something that's in your life needs to be changed dramatically, and can be, and will be, and shall be. And when it is, you become the salt of the earth. And then there's something else, and something that's beyond that. And in time, you become a light that is not hidden under a bushel, but the transformation that's taking place in you is so dramatic that you become a city, a new state of consciousness, a new mentality that is on a hill. You become a peak performer is what you become. And when you're lifted up, you will notice that you will draw all persons unto yourself. This is what Jesus said. Not only all persons, but you will draw to yourself everything that you need at the time that you need it. When you're in the spiritual life, you will always be at the right place at the right time to have the experiences that are designed for you to have, and you will have all the energy that you need, all the power that you need, and the wisdom that you need. Everything that you need will always be provided, and there will never be an exception to that. But you will always have to be practicing where you are in your life, in the circumstances that surround you at the moment. And you know that that's all that has ever been required of us? And this is a requirement that can be met by every person who lives on the planet? Jesus never gave us a system that could not be understood and practiced and realized. And that's what he said. I have fulfilled it, and so can you. When Logan McCabe was 14, his father bought a new Ford truck, and that might not seem like very much today, but in Kansas, in the Dust Bowl days of the 1930s, it was quite an achievement. And Logan's dad noticed how proud his son was. Logan would dust that old truck and that new truck for him and polish it, and he was so proud of it. And one day his dad said, would you like to drive it in town and show it to your city cousins? And Logan was elated. While you're there, his father said, take this dime and bring me back a sack of tobacco. So Logan took the truck to town and showed it off, and his city cousins were envious, and he returned home, and his father asked him how they liked the truck, and it took him about 30 minutes to tell his dad. He was so enthusiastic. And finally, his father said, "Where's my tobacco?" And Logan still had the dime in his pocket. And he said, "I'm sorry, Dad, I forgot." But then eagerly, he said, "Well, I'll just get in the truck and go back into town and get your tobacco." His dad said, "I have a better idea, Logan. Don't take the truck. Walk." It was a 10-mile round trip, and his dad looked up at the sun and said, "It's 4 o'clock now. And in 2 hours, you start milking those cows." And so Logan took off, and he was back on time, but exhausted. And after the chores were over, his father took him aside and said, "Son, I didn't send you back to town afoot just for the tobacco or to punish you for forgetting. But I wanted you to remember, as long as you live, that you have to be dependable. A person who is not dependable isn't worth his salt." Isn't worth his salt. And that's what you and I are learning, that we have to become dependable. And by dependable, I mean consistent. That we have to develop a consistency in our attitude and in our outlook and in our confidence and in our faith. We have to be consistent moment by moment and hour by hour in the midst of the circumstances that surround us. And yes, we might get caught up with a new little toy or a new relationship. And we might think that we have found God in the lottery. But we haven't. We have to be consistent. So consistent that in time, both we ourselves and all other persons know that we don't even have to work at it. We don't even have to think about it. It just is. We are practicing these principles, and we're expecting our miracles, and our attitudes cannot be diminished. It does not matter what happens. Neither life nor death nor good or evil or circumstances, the sun coming up or the sun setting, nothing will diminish us. And you do not think it's possible to live that way? I promise you that it is. And there are men and women on all sides who have achieved it. Often people are just discovering the spiritual life, make the most amazing demonstrations. It's because they hunger and thirst. Remember the Beatitude last week? If you hunger and thirst. And sometimes we lose our hunger. The good becomes the enemy of the better, and we start talking a number that we're not practicing. But I have some wonderful news. If you stop hungering and thirsting, then life is prepared to restore your hunger. And you will meet with some circumstances that will darken your door, and the lights will go out, and it will not be the thunderstorm that blew down the telephone pole on the corner. It will be the thunderstorm that has come back into your world again, and it's there for your good. It is not because God is punishing you at all. Or forgot to mention the person who has the habit of great sin, as they say in the world. Sin, which really means missing the mark. Falling short of what we were created to be. That's what sin is. It's all it is, falling short of your potential. If such a person is desirous of spiritual growth, should he not attempt to get good before he begins to grow? Have you ever wondered about that? Maybe I'm not good enough for the spiritual life. Oh, I have some wonderful news for you. The only way that you're ever going to get good is by practicing spiritual principles in your life. You have to start right where you are, with your state of mind, as unhealthy as you might think it is. And you start. And you surrender. And you struggle a bit. You become willing to be changed. And the most remarkable thing will happen. It will be as though all the love in the universe came to surround you and to consume you, to lift you up. And all that's required is that you observe yourself in an honest way, willing to work against the imperfections that have been there, against the evil, meaning those things that you have permitted to put you down. Remember that evil has no power. The problem has no power any more than darkness has a power. Have you ever at some time in your life gone into a deep, dark cave, into the bowels of the earth? I have. I've been in some of the grandest caves in America. Deep down, hundreds of feet under the earth. And one of the most startling experiences that a person can have is to be underground and wait for the moment when the lights are extinguished. Talking about darkness. You have not seen darkness till you see that darkness. The darkness into which no light can possibly penetrate. I've been there. But do you know that in that darkness there is light? In time you will begin to see a light, and it will be the light, actually the light of your own inner being that is there and it shines. You are a heavenly body. Light that cannot be hidden, even from yourself. In those times, in that darkness, when the light has come back on again, it's been the most amazing thing to realize that darkness does not exist at all. Darkness is nothing more than the absence of light. It's been the light sucked out of the cave, so to speak. Is there a darkness switch? Can you turn on the darkness and extinguish the light that's in this room? Of course you cannot. There is no darkness. There's only the absence of light. And that's all that evil is. That's all that negativity is. And any moment that you desire, you can turn on the light of your own beingness, of your own consciousness. And the darkest time, the darkest hour, the darkest mood will disappear. Try it. Try it. Marvel. Marvel at what happens when you turn on the light of your own being. Your life comes alive again. You become the salt of the earth, the light of the world, a city that is set on a hill and your light cannot be hidden. You become one who is within heaven, because heaven is within you. That's where heaven is, you know, not on the other side of the universe. Heaven is right where you are. And that's why that he said that until our righteousness, until our right application of these principles shall exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees, we shall not enter the kingdom of God. And when that righteousness is there, we can do some incredible thing, some remarkable, some wonderful thing. All that's required is that we need to be honest, genuine in our striving for the perfection that will ultimately be ours, because it already is ours. Do you have an idea about yourself? Something about you that needs to be changed? Do you? In you, is there still a place of darkness? Some corner that has not yet been filled with light? Then go out into your world this week and let your light shine. Practice these principles. Some important area of your life. Carry what you know into your world, and change your conduct in some important way. It's what Jonathan Livingston Seagull suggested when he said, "Let's begin with level flight." God bless you.